Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now, Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler of Manhattan and Brooklyn. Congressman, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
The committees you're on deal with the Constitution and with infrastructure. Let's talk about both. Constitution first. In your opinion, was Trump's military strike on Syria legal, and was it constitutional?
In my opinion, it was neither legal nor constitutional. The Constitution clearly says that the Congress shall have the power to declare war. The framers are very clear that no one man should have the power to drag the country into war on his own, that Congress had to do that. The power to wage war, that is to decide, Congress having declared war, we're going to send the troops here, we're going to send the anti-aircraft there. That's the president as commander-in-chief. He is commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He is not commander-in-chief of the country. So in recent decades, presidents have increasingly, usurped the power of Congress under the not just the excuse, but the somewhat valid reason that, you know, if the missiles are flying or the bombers are flying, God forbid, you don't have the time to call Congress into session. You've got to react. And that's fine. And if there is an imminent threat to the United States, then the president has to react. But here, as in Libya in 2012, when I said the same thing, where there is no imminent threat to the security of the United States, where the question is, should we intervene in an ongoing war for various reasons, there is time to call Congress and to get congressional assent. And that was not done, and there was no excuse for it, and that was unconstitutional. Now, some people say the War Powers Act gives the president the power to act for 60 days. But the War Powers Act, which was passed over President Nixon's veto back in 1973, was an attempt to rein in presidents. And it said if hostilities begun, they had to stop in 60 days if Congress didn't okay their continuation. But it did not grant the president the power to initiate the hostilities in the first place. And had it done so, it would have been unconstitutional on its face.
Now, conservative Republicans often paint themselves as the big constitutionalists these days, precisely on the grounds of one of the points that you made. They see the Constitution as primarily there to limit what government can do, especially the Bill of Rights, not enable government to do a lot.
That is partially correct. And partially not correct. The Bill of Rights was certainly put there to limit certain things that government can do. But the Constitution, don't forget, and this is completely contrary to the Republican and Tea Party narrative, the Constitution was written for exactly the opposite purpose. It was to strengthen the federal government. Under the Articles of Confederation that were enforced from 1781 till the Constitution was ratified in 1789, there was very little central or federal government power. And the country was falling apart, and the Constitutional Convention was called to give power to Congress to regulate interstate commerce, to lay taxes, not just to beg the states for revenues. And the Constitution greatly strengthened and was intended to greatly strengthen the hand of the federal government.
But given the Republicans' main talking points on the Constitution, that it's there to limit the powers of government, do most of your Republican colleagues agree with you that the strike was unconstitutional without their approval?
Well, a lot of my Republican colleagues seem to be very situational. They thought that when President Obama initiated the strike on Libya without getting congressional approval, that was totally wrong and unconstitutional, which I think it was. But now that it's a Republican president doing the same thing, they think it's okay. I think you have to be consistent in your interpretation of the Constitution and what the powers of the president and various other arms of government are.
On the policy itself, if the president had come to Congress asking for authorization for this particular strike, would you have supported it?
I don't know. I would have had a lot of questions to ask. What is our policy? What are we aiming to do? A one-day strike in which you gave warning to the Russians and the Syrians that, in effect, it was a pinprick and did nothing, if not followed up at all, I'm not sure what the purpose is, other than to kill, you know, six or seven people. What is the purpose? We ought to have a purpose in Syria. I don't think we should stand aside and let the horrors go on doing nothing. But I'm not sure what an intelligent policy is, and it's up to the president to recommend an intelligent policy that we could judge and make some judgments about. Now, I think, a policy in which we say, okay, we will bomb somebody in retaliation for some of the horrors they're inflicting, at the same time that we will make sure that we will keep the victims of the horrors there. We won't have any refugees coming here, et cetera. I think that's a very wrong policy.
A wrong policy. So it's been attributed to Hillary Clinton, among other Democrats, that if the president were to come to Congress, well, I'll ask you it this way since you're in Congress. If the president were to come to Congress asking for authorization to destroy all of Syria's military airstrips, I think there are only about six of them, and or set up a no-fly zone as a safe zone in part of the country, which I think Hillary Clinton, among others, had tried to convince Obama to do, how much would you lean toward voting yes on that if asked?
I would seriously consider it. I'd have some questions about it, obviously. What are the risks of getting into conflict with the Russians, for the most part? If you set up a no-fly zone, sounds like a very good thing, and probably is in many ways, but in order to enforce it, you end up fighting Russian aircraft and Russian troops, and does that further escalate into a possible confrontation between the United States and Russia? So I'd want to know a lot more questions before I'd vote for it, but I wouldn't rule it out entirely.
We also have hundreds of ground troops in Syria. Are they there illegally, in your opinion? And that's certainly gone on for more than 60 days.
Well, I don't think they're in combat. They're training other people, et cetera. So I think you can have a much stronger legal case for that.
The Bush-Cheney Iraq rationale was a mistake or a lie. There were no weapons of mass destruction, and Al-Qaeda, which attacked us on 9/11, did not have a base in Iraq. By contrast, ISIS is real and also trying to get people to attack Americans. I'm curious how much that changes what you think our responsibility is in Iraq and Syria today as a matter of national security.
Well, I voted against the Iraq war resolution. I thought that the intelligence was not all that clear, and that Cheney and Bush were lying about the intelligence also. There were various reasons to believe that at the time. ISIS is a threat to the United States. I think, however, that we're ignoring another threat. Iran is a threat to the United States and to Israel, but to the United States. It's a greater threat, in my opinion, than is ISIS, because ISIS cannot project power. Iran can. ISIS can seek to inspire people to blow up bombs here, but it cannot do it itself. Iran has many more capabilities. And I am very concerned that with our fixation on ISIS, and we have to fight ISIS, obviously, but with our fixation on ISIS alone, Iran, in alliance with Hezbollah and Syria, is setting up a Shiite crescent extending from Iran through parts of Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Syria into Lebanon with Hezbollah. That is a threat to Israel and is a threat to the United States. We have to pay attention to that.
So I'm curious, bigger picture, what you think of Trump's sudden reversals on foreign policy in general in the last week. This is what our previous segment was about. NATO is no longer obsolete. China is no longer a currency manipulator. Putin can't be trusted now. And we're bombing Assad supposedly for humanitarian reasons. Is Trump giving up nationalism for globalism?
That remains to be seen. I'm not sure Trump has any coherent viewpoints on foreign policy or on a lot of other things either. He seems to go with some extent with the less people who spoke to him. Now, some of that China is no longer a currency manipulator. China used to manipulate its currency and weaken its currency to make its products more saleable and to weaken us. That seems to have stopped about 4 or 5 years ago. There's no guarantee it won't start again. But that hasn't been a problem for the last 4 or 5 years. And when he was obsessing about it during the campaign, he was just out of date. Now they could start doing that again, although I think the economics dictates that they probably won't. It wouldn't be to their advantage now. So his recognizing that our taking action against China to stop them from doing what they already stopped doing 4 or 5 years ago is ridiculous is good for reality. The fact that he recognizes that we have problems with Russia and that Russia is an aggressive actor, that's good. What we do about it is another question. We don't want to get into a situation of total confrontation with the Russians, obviously. What were his other reversals?
NATO is no longer obsolete. Putin is no longer a great guy.
That's an interesting phrase. When he said NATO is no longer obsolete. It was obsolete. It's no longer obsolete. That's absurd, obviously. But I'm glad he no longer thinks it's obsolete. And he's entering the realm of reality as to what he has to deal with. Now, within that realm, there are different policies he can follow, and we don't know what they're going to be, or if he's thought it through, which I doubt. But I'm glad that Bannon and company seem to be somewhat on the wane because they're absolutely poisonous. And they get their information, as this Trump in a lot of cases, from the right-wing blogs who just make things up and don't know what they're talking about most of the time.
Bannon may sort of be on the wane and sort of not, or at least Bannonism. I mean, I can ask you the very blunt question I asked our journalist guest in the last segment. I don't see any change by Trump on some of Bannon's other big priorities, immigration or Muslim admission. So are we entering a phase where Bannon's white supremacist side still aligns with the president's priorities, but his anti-war side doesn't?
We may be. The white supremacy, the anti-Semitism, the anti-Islamic, that's been there with Trump for a long time pre-Bannon. So, I mean, you can look at some of Trump's discussions from 10, 15 years ago, and he was on some of these things. So it's more than just Bannon. Bannon obviously was brought in because he appealed to the president. He agreed with some of his prejudices, and he was a big thinker. But he is so far out that and in conflict with some other people that his influence may be waning, which is a good thing. But it doesn't mean that Trump's suddenly going to eliminate all these retrograde opinions and prejudices that he acts on.
I gather you want to weigh in, before we leave foreign policy, on what Sean Spicer said when trying to emphasize how bad Assad is the other day, the bumbling, that's the kindest thing I guess you could say about it, that it was a bumbling reference to Hitler not gassing his own people during the Holocaust.
Well, that shows an appalling – what Bannon showed was an appalling ignorance.
Spicer.
I'm sorry, Spicer. What Spicer showed was an appalling historical ignorance and frankly, incompetence. I said he should be fired not because he's a terrible guy, but because he has an appalling ignorance and incompetence. He can't do the job. Now, to talk about and he just kept making it worse. To talk about the fact that Hitler didn't gas his people. Well, of course he did. 2 million people, 2.5 million people were killed in gas chambers, 4 million more in other ways, but in gas chambers. Or in gas vans before they built the extermination camps.
And
they said
later,
he didn't do it to his own people.
Right.
Well, that's feeding the Nazi line that German Jews weren't Germans.
Right.
German Jews were Germans, and they regarded themselves, most of them, as very loyal until they were stripped of their citizenship and stripped of their rights and murdered. So to go along with those kinds of views or to even entertain them shows that he is simply unfit to be where he is.
And he went through a very tortured series of corrections as the day went on and finally an apology. So you're not accusing him of being a Holocaust denier, but you think he should resign anyway?
I think he should resign because he may not consciously deny the Holocaust, but he doesn't know about it. And he feeds into Holocaust denial. And someone who is the press secretary or the communications director of the president has to know history, has to know where we're at, where we've been, has to know this stuff, not just about – and if he doesn't know that, what else doesn't he know? Now, also, he seems to get a lot of his information from reading the right-wing blogs. And the right-wing blogs have been full recently of some of this stuff about, comparing Assad unfavorably to Hitler, rather, that Hitler was worse. And that's
you mean
part
that
of
Assad is even
that
worse.
Assad is worse than Hitler. That's part of Holocaust denialism, too. So someone who gets his information from there uncritically is a problem.
My guest is Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler of Manhattan and Brooklyn. We can take a few phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. It is the Easter and Passover break for Congress, and besides this little town hall meeting, when we start to take some calls, you're having a formal town hall meeting, right?
Tonight at 6 o'clock at Brandeis High School on West 84th Street, and so far about 1,400 people have RSVP'd. How many actually show up, we'll see, but I expect
And to
a lot
do
of
what?
People.
I mean, if you're already a liberal Democrat and the big energy at town halls is liberals confronting Republicans, what's the point of a Gerald Nadler town hall or coming to it?
Well, because I'm the congressman in the district and people want to talk to their congressman, and the congressman ought to get feedback from his own people and, see where they're at and so forth. And people want to express their opinions and their frustrations, I assume. And there may be some Republicans there who who say, why didn't you vote to repeal Obamacare? Not that we had the vote.
All the Republicans who live near West 84th Street.
Right. I'm sure there are some Republicans in my district, and everybody ought to get the chance if they want to confront their congressman and tell him what he's doing right or wrong and so forth.
Good.
Now, So
tonight at 6 at Brandeis High School.
At Brandeis High School,
and people don't need to RSVP. They can just show up.
Yes, although I hope we don't get into a situation where it's beyond however
– sounds like it might be.
– the number of people who can fit there.
Let's move on to infrastructure and more contradictions. Another of your big interests, infrastructure. For years and years, you've been coming on the show talking about the need for another rail tunnel between New York and New Jersey and other things. And Trump says he's for big infrastructure spending, but the Times described how his budget would defund important local projects like the Gateway Tunnel between New York and New Jersey and money to bring the Long Island Railroad into Grand Central as well as Penn Station. What do you think is really going on?
I think he doesn't know what's going on.
That's the answer to a lot of questions, isn't it?
The description we've had of his infrastructure program hasn't been for a while, by the way. But when it was they're going to give an 82% – that was somebody's figure – an 82% tax break to private interests to engage in public-private partnership to build and maintain infrastructure. Well, that's interesting. It won't work. Because the only private people who go into infrastructure go in to make money. That's perfectly reasonable. But so, in other words, you're going to build a road. You're going to have to put a toll on that road. That toll will then pay for the upkeep and the maintenance. You'll bond against the toll. It'll pay for the construction. And the federal government will reduce the cost of the money by giving you will reduce the cost by giving the tax break.
You're talking about private toll roads.
Yes, you're talking about private toll roads. But how do you maintain current highways that way, put tolls on them? How do you maintain and improve water mains, double the water rates? How do you do most things? For most, there may be a very small subset of infrastructure projects which can be financed that way. I'm not saying there's no role for that. But 80-85% of projects cannot be. Now, we do need at least $1 trillion worth of work. The American Engineering Society says we have a $4.6 trillion backlog. And we ought to find, by the way, the way we ought to finance it, we last increased the gasoline tax in 1993, 25 years ago, almost 25 years ago. It's 18.4 cents per gallon. You pay 18.4 cents whether you're paying $2.50 a gallon or $4.50 a gallon. Inflation has reduced that by 40%. If you increased it by one penny, and indexed that to inflation for the future, that would give you $1 trillion over 10 years for real infrastructure. Now, the president had talked about this infrastructure program, but we have not seen it. And instead, what we've seen in his budget proposal, is to defund all kinds of infrastructure programs, to defund the programs that we passed in the transportation bill a few years ago that would be used to fund the Gateway rail tunnel into Penn Station, that would be used to fund the Second Avenue subway, that would be used to fund most major projects, that would be used to continue funding Amtrak. He wants to cut out the long-distance Amtrak, among other things. He just cuts that. And he says, well, I'll have my infrastructure program. Meanwhile, cut everything, and later maybe we'll see an infrastructure program.
So this is another thing that people need to stay on because it hasn't emerged yet. What will the Trump infrastructure program actually be? And so if people are concerned about actual public infrastructure, this needs to be an ongoing conversation.
Absolutely, especially since the Republicans in Congress are basically opposed to major infrastructure payments. They don't want to touch the gasoline tax or any other revenue source.
It's an interesting point you made about the gasoline tax that I think a lot of people don't realize. It's not a percentage. It's just a number of pennies. And therefore, it loses value over time with inflation. I think a lot of people didn't know that before. But A lot of Republicans who oppose the infrastructure spending make an argument that infrastructure is local and so it should be a local expense. So if you have a new tunnel between New York and New Jersey for the sake of New Jersey commuters and, you know, general ease of getting around in the New York metro area, why is that the responsibility of taxpayers in Kansas or California?
Well, for one thing, it's not local. that new tunnel is necessary for the entire Northeast Corridor. If you want to go by train from Washington to Boston, you've got to use the tunnels through, you know, through Penn Station. There's no other way to do it. So a lot of these projects are not just local; they're national or regional. Second of all, the federal government has a much bigger tax base than local governments, and can do it much more easily and can spread the burden. Thirdly, if you really wanted to take that argument and say, well, it's up to local government, fine. New York is a donor state. We have a balance of payments deficit with the federal government of close to $30 billion. That is to say, we collect about $30 billion more in federal taxes here than is spent here. Now, nothing terribly improper about that. We have a lot of rich people here. They pay higher income tax rates. But if you want to say everything should be local, fine. Don't send the money to Washington. We'll spend it locally. That would help states like New York, who would murder most of the Republican states, most of the red states. But you got to be consistent. Do it one way or the other.
That's a whole other show. Why the states that get the most from the federal government and pay the least into the pool tend to be the most anti-Washington spending. But that's, right, but that's another show.
That's a different show about politics, yes, and psychology.
Exactly.
But my point is, if you're going to say the federal government shouldn't fund these kinds of, yes, projects, then
don't
keep the money
us
local,
right,
and we'll fund them.
Let me get a couple of calls in. Judy in Chelsea, you're in Congressman Nadler's district. You're,
yes,
on WNYC.
Thank you for taking my call. Congressman, could you weigh in on the lawsuit being brought in relation to the Emoluments Clause being brought by law professor Zephyr Teachout and, I believe, other law academics? And I'll leave it to you to explain a little bit about the Emoluments Clause. But basically what I'd like to learn is, do you think this lawsuit has, as they say, legs?
The Emoluments Clause of the Constitution.
Well, the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution says that no federal official, from the president to the postman, can get...
Or woman,
certainly, can get any payment or emolument meaning anything of value, from any foreign state, prince, or potentate, the operative word being state these days. Now... If you're Donald Trump and you have a lot of business interests, and let's say you have the Trump Hotel in Washington, and various foreign governments suddenly decide that, gee, it would be nice to brown-nose the president by having their delegations to the trade conference or whatever stay in his hotel. That's an emolument.
He's profiting from that.
He's directly profiting from that. If the Chinese just gave certain trademark or copyright approvals to the Trump Organization, which had been requested 4 or 5 years ago, and they said yes, even if you assume that that would have been done in the normal course of the business, suddenly it's done, that's an emolument. So I think it's highly illegal. Now, how do you enforce that? There's a problem called standing. You can only go into court if there's a case or controversy. And the case or controversy means that you, as the plaintiff, have to have a particular interest. So you can't sue the federal government and say, I think that foreign aid to Indonesia is too much. You can tell your congressman to vote against it, but you don't have a standing different from any other taxpayer. Now, some of the lawsuits that have been filed by CRU, the Committee for Responsible Ethics in Washington, they may have a standing problem in that how are the people involved in CRU more specifically injured by this? On the other hand, a lawsuit has been filed recently by a restaurant that competes with the president, with the restaurants in the Trump Hotel.
Uh-huh.
I think they have very good standing because they have a specific injury in that the foreign delegation might otherwise eat in their restaurant or stay in their hotel instead of going there. So I think that you can surmount the standing problem, and I think you have a very strong lawsuit.
So if there's a lawsuit based on the Emoluments Clause against Donald Trump, this year's income tax filing deadline is coming up in a few days. You've been outspoken about this issue in the past.
Sure.
Do you see tax day or this lawsuit, which would presume to need to look at his finances, as an opportunity to force the new ones out?
Well, first of all, the fact that he doesn't file his tax return or doesn't publicize his tax returns, unlike every other modern American president, is a disgrace, especially since he's got such huge business interests, which he hasn't divested himself from, which is another disgrace, so that foreign governments, foreign interests can directly profit the president by various business deals. and these are not revealed. You might see them in the tax returns. It's all disgraceful that it's not revealed.
I read there's an obscure clause under which his new return goes automatically into audit, which has been his excuse for not releasing them. True?
That's right. The president's tax return goes automatically into audit. I didn't know that either until about a week ago. But there's no excuse. You can release your tax return whether it's being audited or not. Now, the fact that these lawsuits are there, I don't expect these lawsuits to be coming into court for months and months, so I don't think it'll have anything to do with the release of this taxes now. But Congress ought to force the release of those tax returns, and we have made attempts through the Ways and Means Committee to do so. We have the power, but the Republicans have voted it down totally. Now, I've filed a number of resolutions of inquiry and gotten other Democrats to do the same. A resolution of inquiry, my resolution of inquiry asks that the Justice Department give to Congress all documents, tax returns, et cetera, related to any, to the emolument, any possible violation of the Emoluments Clause related to the Russians' help to the Trump campaign, to possible collusion by the Trump campaign, and to any possible violations of 18 other specific statutes.
So tying those things together.
Tying those things together, if we got that information, it would be very good and it would reveal a lot. The Republicans voted it down. The advantage of a resolution of inquiry is that you get a vote, at least in committee. So I've gotten that a vote on a party line basis. We have forced some other resolutions of inquiry now, and we're going to continue that campaign.
So we just have 30 seconds left, but would Trump's meeting with the president of China at Mar-a-Lago last week be a case of the U.S. government and the Chinese government paying tax money from each to Trump because he owns the resort, and so on the China side being a violation of the Emoluments Clause?
Well, I'm not going to rule specifically. I'm not a court, but I would think so. I would think yes.
Congressman Gerald Nadler of Brooklyn and Manhattan, you want to publicize that town hall, or do you want to downplay the now because it's going to be oversubscribed?
Well, people should know about it. It's going to be tonight at 6 o'clock at Brandeis High School on the Upper West Side on West 84th Street. But we expect the mob scene.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.